All right, so tonight we're going to finish our look, our primary look at the text. Next week, we don't have it up there just yet. I don't know, were they signaling 5 minutes back there? 5 minutes before we have slides? Okay, anyway. Next week, I thought we might take a look. If you heard Jesse's lesson Sunday evening, go listen to it again. If you haven't, go listen to it for the first time. I believe it's on our website. But he mentioned something about the connection between Genesis and the book of John, the language of Genesis and particularly of creation. Certainly found abundantly in the Gospel of John, and appreciate Jesse bringing that to light. And I thought, well, maybe we could carve out, we have one entire class session left. What if we spent an entire session just mining scripture to see that language? Because it's really all throughout the Bible. And I would say one of the reasons for that would be time well spent, because it demonstrates, it's one way of demonstrating just how foundational the book of Genesis indeed is to the rest of Scripture. If you just chuck Genesis out or discount it or, you know, ridicule it, especially the first 11 chapters, you have just undermined the entire framework and story of the Bible. So it all goes together, and we really get some insight into how the other Bible writers, how Jesus viewed the book of Genesis. So God willing, next week at this same time, we'll look at what I'll call Genesis in the Scriptures. Okay, let's take a look now at Genesis 46 through 50. Without our slide up here, I'll just tick these off here, but I want to just go briefly through a list of headings, if you will, similar to what we've done before. If you've seen previous slides, just imagine that's what that slide looks like here. So the first heading I have is for chapter 46 and verses 1 through 4, where God reassures Jacob. It's just one more instance of God affirming to Jacob that he remains in complete control, that he has not forgotten his promises, that everything that he has said he will do, he will indeed bring it to fruition. I want you to notice in the text in Genesis 46, verse 2, God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, "Jacob, Jacob," and he said, "Here I am." He said, "I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt." And then next he says, "For I will make you a great nation there." And you think, well, maybe we have two promises here that are in competition with one another. We're going to go down to Egypt and multiply. Okay, we're going to become a great nation there, but what about this land? God is just affirming to Jacob, "I've not forgotten about any of those promises. They're going to all come to pass. I've not forgotten about the promise to make you a great nation. It will be there." Now, that's similar to what God affirmed to Abraham. Your descendants will live in a land that's not theirs. They'll be enslaved there for centuries and will come out with many possessions. Likewise, God says to Jacob, he's essentially saying to Jacob, "It is part of my plan and purpose for you to be in Egypt. Yes, there are the circumstances of the famine, but God has simply used those circumstances to advance his purpose." And so a lot of unknowns, right? We just kind of take for granted that these people are willing to just uproot and take all their possessions and go to what is for them a completely different part of the world. We just take it for granted maybe that they're going to just have the faith to do that. Well, I think God understands what he understood with Abraham and what he understood with Isaac and what he understands with us, that sometimes we have real fears. We want to trust God, But we struggle sometimes. I believe God understands that. He understood that with Jacob. And so he says, knowing his heart, do not be afraid to go down to Egypt. The promise is just as important to me as the day I first uttered it to Abraham. I will make you a great nation there. Egypt is part of the plan. Joseph's already there in his mind, isn't he? God has brought this about. I will, and then notice, we'll come back to this statement later. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again. So any lingering, doubts about the land promise, God addresses those there. You and your family will be back here. I've not forgotten about, I think he could be hinting at the land promise here. And he further says, Joseph will close your eyes, which we're about to read about that great reunion here shortly. So God reassures Jacob. Okay, there we go. Thank you, guys. And then later in chapter 46, Jacob and his family indeed make the trek all the way to Egypt. I thought about putting up our map again, decided not to. But we get a sense of the general route that they took. Verse 5, he arose from Beersheba. And the sons of Israel carried their father Jacob and their little ones and their wives in the wagons which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. We read about Pharaoh supporting this move in the previous section. And so Jacob, with a full heart, full assurance of faith, if I can borrow from Hebrews language, took everything. Verse 6, their livestock, their property, which they had acquired in the land of Canaan, came to Egypt, Jacob and all his descendants with him, his sons, his grandsons with him, his daughters and his granddaughters, and all his descendants he brought with him to Egypt. And then starting with verse 8, down through, let's say verse 27, somewhere around there, we actually have a listing, don't we, of these descendants of Jacob. Some people like to make a big deal out of the fact that in Acts chapter 7 and verse 14, Stephen says that there were 75 people that came to Jacob, or came to Egypt, whereas here it says it rounds it off as 70. I don't think it's difficult to reconcile these. I think it could be argued there are different methods of counting here that certainly could explain the discrepancy. There are certainly, what is not a dispute is that there are 66 direct descendants of Jacob. They're listed here in the text. Do the math for yourself. And then after that, if you add Jacob, Joseph, and then Manasseh and Ephraim, that's how you get to 70. But it's clear from chapter 50, Jacob had other extended family. Maybe that is what Stephen was counting. The Septuagint, I believe, may show 75, the Greek translation of the Old Testament. So it really just comes down to others being included in the count, not really a contradiction. Anyway, but the point is that these 70, 75 people, 70-ish people, are going to go into Egypt, and they're going to come out what? It's probably going to number a couple of million. We're just estimating, right? There were 603,000, I think, at one point, 550 fighting men. Then you count the women and children, all those multipliers. You quickly get to an estimate of some 2 to 4 million people. But Exodus chapter 1 is going to say that the people will multiply exceedingly. That's one of the these chapters here, of course, set the stage for the continuing narrative that is known as Exodus, the next part of the story. But these 70 go down to Egypt. And then, of course, at the end of chapter 46, we have this beautiful reunion between Jacob and Joseph. Verse 28, we see Jacob again. Judah has emerged as a leader among his brothers. He sends Judah before him to Joseph to point out the way before him to Goshen. Verse 29, Joseph prepared his chariot and went up to Goshen to meet his father Israel. As soon as he appeared before him, he fell on his neck and wept on his neck a long time. Don't you, as a reader, just want to pause and give that the requisite meditation it deserves? After all that has transpired, after all that Joseph has endured, that expression, long time, deserves at least a, maybe not in class, but some time for us to sit and reflect. What are some things we could reflect on here at this moment in the story?
Jacob believed
that he was dead all these years. There's Jacob learning that Joseph, in fact, is alive. What does all of this say about God? He is gracious and merciful and has not forgotten Jacob, has not forgotten Joseph either. And now it's a little bit of a foretaste of, you know, if this was as great as we imagine it was, how much can we make a how much more argument? What about heaven? What about the people we all know that have already passed, crossed the river, as we sometimes say? What a reunion that will be. God has not forgotten us in our grief. And in fact, what parent would not say what Israel says in verse 30, "Now let me die, since I have seen your face, that you are still alive." Jacob, while he will say to Pharaoh here soon, "My days have been few and unpleasant," yet also now he feels a measure of fulfillment and closure and is so grateful. We're going to see later, Jacob's language about God has changed as he's grown, as he's endured, as he's matured. I think a lot of these players in the story have indeed grown and matured in their faith. We've seen growth in Judah. You could argue we've seen some growth with Reuben, probably all the brothers. We've certainly seen growth with Joseph. We've seen growth with Jacob. And you know, there's that one story we talked about very early on in our association together, the story of Leah, which we don't have time, sadly, to explore tonight. But Jacob's attitude toward Leah has changed over these years, and we see him honoring Leah in a way that he had not even come close to doing before. So Jacob and Joseph are reunited, and of course Pharaoh, I was a little bit amused, just to say this in passing, Joseph tells the brothers what to say to Pharaoh, said, "Don't say you're shepherds." Well, of course, they say they're shepherds. Anyway, we'll talk about that statement in verse 34, "Every shepherd is loathsome to the Egyptians." But Pharaoh is very glad that Joseph's family has come. He opens up the bounty of the land to the family. Now that we have these slides, we probably should use them. And so the family settles in Goshen, chapter 47 and verse 6. "The land of Egypt is at your disposal. Settle your father and your brothers in the best of the land. Let them live in the land of Goshen. And if you know any capable men among them," as in your brothers, their sons, etc., "put them in charge of my livestock." He's giving Joseph full rein to put them to work and find good positions for them. So Joseph has pledged to take care of them, and indeed that's what he's doing. Joseph brought his father Jacob and presented him to Pharaoh. And then notice, so now in the middle of this could deserve a separate heading, but notice what it says twice, verse 7 and verse 10. Jacob blessed Pharaoh. I don't want to make too much of that, but for me, I get a little bit of a Hebrews 7 vibe there. Why Hebrews 7? Because that's the Melchizedek text where it says that Melchizedek blessed Abraham. And essentially it says, without any dispute, the lesser It's blessed by the greater. Well, that won't be the posture of Pharaoh in our next book of the Bible. But here, Pharaoh is viewed differently, views himself differently. I dare say is probably more humble. Is it humbler? Anyway, than he will be later, generations later. Jacob blesses Pharaoh. I'll just leave you to think about that. That was a statement that struck me. But the family settles in Goshen. Joseph is taking the role of the caretaker of the family. He is going to receive the double portion, and is really assuming the responsibility, verse 12, of providing for his father and his brothers and all his father's household. Now, then in verses 13 through 26 is something interesting. I would again preface my remarks by saying I wouldn't want to make too much of this. Talk to me about, we just alluded to it, how Pharaoh was viewed and regarded in the time of Moses among the Egyptians. How was Pharaoh viewed, regarded among the Egyptians in the time of Moses? He was a god. He was the, I don't know, okay, Curtis said that. He was probably seen as the greatest of the gods, truth be told. And that last plague came directly after him, didn't it? All the plagues showed God's superiority and supremacy over the Egyptian deities. But I think here in 47, we could have something of an evolution in terms of how Pharaoh is viewed. And I'm certainly open to discussion about this, if not now, perhaps afterward. But notice Joseph, as he executes the charge given to him, begins to acquire in the name of Pharaoh more and more and more stuff. And I'm not finding my notes here. So, but if you just let your eyes run over this, the first thing that Joseph gathers, verse 14, is all the money. So he's collecting money in exchange for food. Well, then the people run out of money. So now what could they use to trade? Verse 16, Joseph says, give up your livestock and I will give you food for your livestock. And so they go through some iterations of that. And then pretty soon, Pharaoh owns all the livestock, the horses, the flocks, the herds, the donkeys. The next year, verse 18, they come and say, there's nothing left for my Lord except our bodies and our land. So basically, by the end of this, they have yielded up everything they own, everything that they could possibly offer, including themselves, in service to Pharaoh. And so Pharaoh ends up owning the whole land. Pharaoh begins to be seen. I mean, he is with that kind of power, is as you could well imagine, is going to come a change in how the Pharaoh will present himself and how he will conduct himself. It's inevitable. I was thinking of the expression in the book of Exodus where God says, Moses was to say to Pharaoh, or Aaron was to say to Pharaoh, I can't remember, I have raised you up. I have raised you up. I would just suggest that to some extent he used Joseph to do that. Again, just for your further study. But this is another example of how really the end of Genesis is just setting the table for all of that conflict between Pharaoh and God, between Pharaoh and Moses and Aaron. And God will, of course, flex his power and show himself to be superior to any god in Egypt, to any nation on the planet. Egypt, of course, was the maybe the big bad bully on the block would be one way of putting it. So anyway, let me pause at this point. Any observation or two that you'd like to share so far? We're just hitting the highlights of the text like we've been doing. I have some other things to take you through, but I'll pause now and ask if anyone has a comment. We have a couple of microphones back here. We have a up here.
This last event of the multiplication of wealth and concentration into either the government or under the power of Joseph is a fulfillment of be fruitful and multiply, the command at the beginning.
What's the fulfillment of be fruitful and multiply?
I said it seems like a fulfillment of that command that God gave to his people to be fruitful and multiply.
Mm. And they will in Egypt.
Yeah. And they do.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, he will cause them to multiply if Pharaoh's efforts to impose population control are going to fail. God will, there's no aspect of this that God isn't in control of. Okay, so in chapter 47 beginning, really through the end of 49, I could have broken this up into multiple sections, but I just call this Jacob's final words to his sons, not all at one time. There's the conversation between Jacob and Joseph at the end of 47. There's the exchange between Jacob and Joseph in 48, and that seems to be a separate instance. And then chapter 49, of course, he summons his sons and he prophesies of them and of things to come. And at the end of 49, it would seem that as soon as he finished charging them, that was his moment to be gathered to his people. And so we're presented here with some of the very last things that Jacob will say, and the focus is on his sons. I believe this demonstrates on Jacob's part a belief in God's promise when he says, I will make of you a great nation there in Egypt. Now Jacob, realizing he is about to depart, his mind goes toward these 12 sons and of days ahead, and God is going to fulfill his promise. But that doesn't mean that these 12 sons don't need to hear some things. There are some not-so-veiled rebukes here in chapter 49. For instance, there are some encouragements. He wants to be buried in Canaan. That's part of what Jacob addresses, his burial plan. There is the blessing, giving Joseph the blessing, in effect, by blessing his two sons. He's claiming Manasseh and Ephraim as his descendants. I think they probably are counted in the 70 here. And so he speaks to Joseph about that. Of course, one of the interesting things about this whole thing, it's kind of a deja vu, right? Here you have a patriarch that can't see very well. Let's see, where have we seen that before? And there are two sons, and which of them will get the blessing? And some concern over that. And Jacob here, I think we see here Jacob is indeed functioning as a prophet. He does what with his hands? He crosses them. Okay, Jacob has brought them up and positioned them such that Manasseh will be at Jacob's right hand and Ephraim at the left. But Jacob reaches his right hand over and places it on Ephraim's head, his left hand on Manasseh. Now both will become significant tribes in Israel. But Ephraim, another case of the younger being elevated above the older. There just seems to be this continual continual theme here. All right, hastening on, chapter 49. Lots to be noticed here about the prophecies concerning his sons. Of Reuben, he says he is uncontrolled as water. He cites some good qualities that Reuben had, not just as a function of his birth order, but also Reuben had some potential to be a leader among his brothers. Reuben squandered that, though, didn't he? His spiritual Achilles heel, if you will, was his lack of self-control. Can you think of one particular instance of that? Leon?
He went up to his father's couch.
He had relations with Bilhah, I think. That was the mother of two of the sons, and at the moment it escapes me which two, but Bilhah, I think maybe being Rachel's handmaid. Anyway, Jacob hears about it, and he hasn't forgotten about it. He says, uncontrolled as water. So that says there's strength there, but sadly, that strength has not been harnessed for good. Now, I would hope we could, there are lessons to be gleaned from that for us, aren't there? Are we harnessing the strength within us that God has given us, the influence, the potential for good? Are we harnessing that to His glory? How many men and women have squandered their influence because they were uncontrolled as water? Simeon and Levi, similarly, failed to show good quality when they were in another way uncontrolled as water. How so?
After their sister was raised, they took revenge against Jacob.
Righteous cause of being indignant about the rape of their sister, but the way in which they went about it, I don't believe what God would have wanted them to do. I mean, to say nothing of the trouble that it caused Jacob, all of it. But Simeon and Levi, Jacob remembers their violence. He notes of their anger, it is fierce, their wrath is cruel, a couple of parallel statements there. He speaks of their self-will. They had made their minds up, and nothing was going to change it. That's not an especially good quality. In some circumstances, self-willed. Reminds me of 1 Timothy 3 or Titus 1 when it says, a man who would serve as an overseer must not be self-willed. It is not a leadership quality. But then Judah, he says of him, your brother shall praise you. He cites that he will be victorious, that to him would be allegiance and honor. He is a lion's whelp, in other words, a young lion. And so there's strength, there's courage, there's potential, there's leadership. Judah will be the tribe of rulers. And then Jacob speaks of Zebulun and Issachar. He puts all of Leah's sons together. He speaks to all of them first. Zebulun will dwell along the seashore, be a haven for ships. Issachar, interesting, a strong donkey lying down between sheepfolds. There's something of a... maybe of an attitude running through Issachar. A willing burden bearer, however. Then he speaks to, and he splits up Dan and Naphtali, and he speaks to Gad and Asher in between them, but the four sons of the two handmaids, Dan, Gad, Asher, and Naphtali, and then moving ahead here, he speaks of Joseph being fruitful, conquering, overcoming bitter attacks. God will help him, great blessings, distinguished, the language of being distinguished among his brothers, no surprise to us as students of Genesis. And then Benjamin, the one, by the way, who easily had the most sons go with him down to Egypt, It shows in the listing of the grandsons, Benjamin had 10 sons. No one else had that many. He says he will be a ravenous wolf. So he may be the youngest, but he can put up a fight as well as the next tribe. And Benjamin's going to have some conflicts with his brethren in coming years. At one point, Benjamin will be nearly wiped out. Anyway, all very interesting. But then we come ahead to chapter 50, where we have the death and the burial of Jacob. Jacob dies at the end of 49. A heart-wrenching scene, chapter 50, verse 1. Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. Since 40 days were required to embalm him, the Egyptians, verse 3, wept for him 70 days. The Egyptians revered Joseph. They appreciated Joseph. Earlier, they had said to him, "You have saved our lives." Well, in honoring Joseph, they honor Joseph by honoring Jacob. This also, by the way, all sets the stage for that statement in Exodus where it says a new Pharaoh arose who did not know Joseph. What Joseph did for the land would be long remembered until it wasn't. Joseph seeks permission to honor Jacob's burial request. Pharaoh, of course, supports that fully. He and the brothers go up to Canaan and bury him in the cave of the field of Machpelah, verse 13, before Mamre, which Abraham had bought along with the field for a burial site from Ephron the Hittite. You think of those generations buried there. Earlier, in chapter 49, if we want to note verse 31, here's how we know that Leah was dead by this time. I assume Bilhah and Zilpah were also dead. Rachel was dead. And so none of them went down to Egypt. But along the way, we're not told when Leah was buried. But Jacob buried Leah also in the cave at Machpelah. Jacob would be buried beside Leah. Noteworthy. Okay, so then the brothers, of course, are scared to death. Joseph's been nice to us because Jacob's still with us. Would you have thought that? You don't have to answer out loud. I think I would have been a little bit fearful of what Joseph might do. And they weren't shy about saying so. They send people, so scared they are. In verse 16, they send a message to Joseph. And so they seek forgiveness. They beg for forgiveness. Now I want you to notice the end of verse 17. I highlighted this sentence. Joseph wept when they spoke to him. That statement speaks volumes, doesn't it? Joseph wept when they spoke to him. That wasn't grief over his father. They'd all had time to mourn that. I want you to see the heart. It's awesome. Genesis closes with the death of Joseph. It would appear that at least some of his brothers survived him. We're not told when each of them died, but there were brothers left. When Joseph is about to die, he gives orders. And notice, this is a fitting closing to our study of Genesis. God will surely take care of you and bring you up from this land to the land which he promised on oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones up from here, a statement that will not be forgotten when Exodus is written. So Joseph died at the age of 110 years, and he was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. I'll just splash this up here for the sake of time. Remember we talked about chiasm a little bit? I found another example of one. I'm not going to go through it. I'm just going to splash it up here. Where you get, you know, and some of them are, like this one, are constructed where you have two statements that are separated, one's at the beginning of a section, one's at the end, and they run parallel to each other. And then the next two statements fit each other, and the next two, and the next two. And you can kind of see that here a little bit. Beginning of Joseph's story, end of Joseph's story. By the way, we're putting all of these slides, some weeks I've been a little bit delinquent, on our website in the members section. If you want to know how to access these, I'll post them in PDF. So you don't have to feverishly copy this down. You can just go look at it at your leisure, okay? All right. You ready to do this? Okay. I want you to discuss with each other. This is where I'm really glad I have one more session. I want you, here, I'll give you a little assignment for next week. I want you to think about, I want you to find some glimpses of Jesus in this section, 46 through 50. We'll talk about those at the beginning, and then we'll talk about Genesis elsewhere in the scriptures. I want to use our last 5 minutes to talk about this. What lessons should Israel have learned from this part of Genesis? Okay, Israel, well, Israel wasn't even a nation at this point. They're a family of some 70 people. But they're going to become a nation. We've seen God hasn't forgotten about that promise. He's told Jacob it's coming. Okay, Moses will record this for that nation to be. And by that time, that nation is not just to be, it is. What lessons should Israel have learned from this part of Genesis? This is one more opportunity to speak to your neighbor. Don't hurt yourself. Let me say that again. No back injuries tonight. Okay, no lost time injuries. Josh is going to set us up with a 5-minute timer, which is about how much we have left. So whenever you guys can go ahead, and I'm showing 20 till, so by a quarter till, oh, there it is. How about that? Wow. You can't not see that. What do y'all think? Okay. We don't have time to discuss all of your discussion, but I hope you found that helpful. That I'm going to just guess, well, and I gathered this from one of the discussions, is that the lessons don't change really from generation to generation, do they? Worth meditating on, and I hope it was helpful to you. All right, next week we're going to talk about Genesis language throughout Scripture. We're not covering all 66 books of the Bible, okay? But we'll touch on a few things. Try not to spend so much time in John. Jesse's already done fine work there, so. There are plenty of other places to look.